Jimmy Muyaha is leading the conversation all across South Africa right now. Stay tuned to SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news with Mr. Khosa at 7 o'clock. Today we are continuing with our reflections on some very interesting and bizarre international laws. If you happen to find yourself in Thailand, be very, very careful about where it is that you walk. The last thing you want to do in Thailand is find yourself accidentally stepping on any currency in Thailand. This is because the currency in Thailand bears the faces of the king, the queen, the heir apparent, or the regent of Thailand. And if anyone is seen to be defaming that, insulting it, or threatening it, they could be liable for a jail term of between 3 and 15 years, even if you happen to do so by accident. So next time you're in Thailand, be wary of stepping on currency that is on the ground. You're tuned into the SFM Market Update with MoneyWeb. I'm your host, Jimmy Muyaha. And on the show today, we are taking a look at the Gazprom Bank deal with the Mossel Bay refinery in South Africa. That is, of course, that gas to liquid refinery. We're going to be speaking to independent analyst Tsepo Radima around that deal. It looks as though it is on rocky ground and we might not have it for much longer. There's been some conversations, very little commitment, very little delivery on that, and we're going to understand, or try and understand why at least. Then we've got a conversation with Professor Hugo Pinar from Cliff Decker Hofmeyer around the latest amendments to the Employment Equity Act, but also around the draft code of best practice that's been put out with regards to the Labor Relations Act as it relates to dismissals. So employment conversations and employment legislation there, two different pieces of legislation we're going to try and look at there, try and understand what some of those changes are in both cases. Then we've got a conversation with the Financial Sector Conduct Authority. We typically do this on a Wednesday, Warning Wednesdays, but this is not Warning Wednesdays. This time we're going to be taking a look at the contributions to pension funds. So perhaps it is a Warning Wednesday feature, but more of a warning towards the employers. They are employers who have not paid their pension fund contributions, and this is to the tune of 5 billion rand. The FSCA is tired of this. They've been telling employers to pay up so that the employees that they're contributing on behalf of have pensions to retire. We're going to speak to the FSCA. We're going to see what's happening here, and we're going to see what is being done about it. And then because it's Wednesday, we're going to wrap up the show with an executive lounge segment. I'm joined in on the line by the CEO of Rosant to take a look at what it is that he does. He's the incoming CEO. We're going to get a sense of what the Rosant business does, but also how he got there.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
As usual, we start off the show with how the markets have been moving throughout the day. I'm joined on the line by Sasfin Wealth's David Shapiro to reflect on some of the market movements. Uncle David, good evening. Lovely to catch up as always. CPI data coming through pretty much in line with expectations, missing ever so slightly, but nothing to be concerned about from a South African perspective. It doesn't look like we're seeing a sharp reversal from that perspective. What did you make of the data?
Look, 3%. I mean, that's why I can't understand, and we're going to have this argument forever about, you know, why rates can't come down. I know there's a fear, you know, there's a fear, or there was the fear of tariff increases by Trump that would be inflationary, push inflation up and reverse, you know, reverse the concerns that we had. But, you know, somewhere along the line, I just hope it can last there. But with our repo rate, where's it, about 7.5 or 7.75? I can't remember. We discussed that before. There is the margin for rate cuts. But if you listen to our governor at Davos, there wasn't any indication that this is going to go down. Still very, very cautious. So, and the markets, you know what was also interesting is that if you looked at our markets today, our retailers kept coming down. So, you know, it's having led the market up last year, 2024, they're very sloppy, even though we're getting reasonable results out of Clicks and very good, you know, results out of Mr. Price today. Still retail sector under a bit of pressure. So, I don't know, we need some love, and this, you know, the Setch is not giving it to us.
Uncle David, do you think part of that is just his managing of expectations? Because that's been the approach that all central bank governors have taken. It's certainly been the approach from the South African Reserve Bank to not want to have the market almost front run the decisions that they make. And perhaps we are in for a rate cut, but he just doesn't want everyone to get excited.
No, look, he's a very cautious man, and don't take anything away from him. Thank goodness for the not only the Treasury but also for the Reserve Bank, who've kept this economy, you know, really steady under very difficult circumstances. But I look at it purely from a market point of view, very selfish point of view. You know, looking at saying, look, it's we need for the economy, we need some kind of stimulus to come about. And, you know, we need rates to come down quite dramatically. I mentioned this before. We're borrowing still, if you're on overdraft rates, you know, you're still around 11% or thereabouts, which is very high, and it makes it extremely difficult for any business to borrow and expand. So at 3%, this is, I think core was at 3.5. So if we take that as being the inflation number with which to work, there's still quite a bit of margin, you know, which by which rates can come down. But of course, looking ahead, and I haven't got the models to do that, there are obviously some concerns about what lies ahead.
Uncle David, I want to pick your brain about something. I know I will get an honest answer out of you for this one. You mentioned the margin, you mentioned the room that's there for the cuts, and this might be a very unpopular opinion to some, but if we're sitting at 7.75% on the repo rate, plus the additional 3.5% that then gets added on to get to the prime lending rate, if we, from a central bank perspective, at least come out and say that difference from the additional 3.5% premium that would be going to the commercial banks, if we slash that by a percent, realistically, only the banks are going to be upset about that. Consumers won't be too mad about that. Is that something that would worry the market? Is that something where the market would see that as a negative?
You got to take this up with the banks. No, I'm serious. You got to take a why. Is there that 3.5 margin? I mean, when we look at the balance sheets, they're not exactly struggling out there. You know, if you go look at the buildings and the cars they drive and the salaries that the bankers receive, there's no stress. You know, very, very solid. And most of our banks, you can't even get money out of them. They're so tight. So there is, you bring up a point that I think, in fact, I think there is a whole investigation now into lending practices. So I think, you know, why is that margin 3.5%? I don't know. It's just been tradition, custom. So you need somebody with a greater idea of you know, of the banking systems and why that's there. You know, why do they need that? Is there any particular reason that they can't actually bring rates down? What they're going to come back and say is, look, we do have flexible rates. If you're a rich person and very wealthy, we're not going to charge you prime. If you're a poor person, you know, and you're not going to pay us, we're going to charge you prime plus. So I suppose there are flexible rates in the banks. But, I mean, we do pitch the prime at 3.5, you know.
But the reality around those flexible rates is that the majority of the population are not rich individuals. So that's something that has to be considered. In fact, the majority of South Africans might be in a similar situation to the UK, where they're facing a serious debt problem. And I saw something a little earlier that said that investor Ray Dalio is also concerned around the UK debt spiral that's happening there. What do we make of those developments when we look at the world and the positioning? Obviously, like the UK, an economy like the UK going through a debt spiral is a concern.
It is. And the only way you can get out of it is to grow. If you've been watching a lot of the interviews at Davos or listening to people commenting on Trump, the biggest worry is if he introduces his policies, it's going to increase debt. And the only way they can get out of debt is to grow. So they've got to grow the economy. Otherwise, there are issues that that will face, you know, face the U.S. economy, face the global economy. So, it's these we can't just brush them aside. But I think there's no other way to get out of it is to push up growth, and you're going to push up growth by reducing interest rates. And you can see it from our point of view as well. You've got me on very weak ground here. You know that. This is not my area. That I should have prepared for this one a little bit better. But what? I think, Jimmy, we're touching very sensitive areas. You know, these are very, very serious, and particularly in the South African context as well. We need to grow this economy. You know, we need to put a lot more into it as well. And we've got to come out with policies that do get us out of number one debt, help the poor, and just bring back some growth, back to us. I know there are a lot of external problems and structural problems, but it's got to be a priority.
Certainly, yep. Something we have to be looking at. Before I let you go, Uncle David, I want to get your thoughts on some of the other movements that we've been seeing. Commodity prices finally kind of stabilizing. Platinum still lagging. Palladium kind of coming around. Gold price moving up quite nicely. The Brent crude price also etching up a little higher. We're seeing a bit of more risk-off sentiment in the market, but not too much because on the other side of it, equity is also moving.
Yeah, no, globally, I mean, the U.S. is storming ahead. I think it's within touching distance of its all-time high. I'm talking about the S&P 500. AI stocks and tech stocks are booming, NASDAQ and so on. In fact, even Europe has come around. If you look at luxury stocks, you know, they've turned around very strongly. LVMH, we know Richemont had a very strong week and so on. So there's a bit of momentum building in the global economy. We haven't seen it here, and it's a bit of a concern. But I think it's too early to call a turnaround in the commodity market, but it's not going down. In other words, it's not falling from these levels. It's stabilizing at these levels. But we need that. We need that to help us out as well. So platinum, I know, is picking up, you know, on Trump's policies towards or his views on EVs, electric vehicles as well. It might just give us a bit of a boost. But we are lagging a bit now, but the rest of the world is doing well.
What do we have in store for the rest of the year? I mean, it is still very, very early in the year, and we know that there's still so much up in the air at the moment around some of the geopolitical issues. But we've seen a lot more optimism, and I think this year could potentially be a better year than last year. How are you feeling about this year?
Very strongly. And I think that it's going to be a year when inflation starts to come down globally, which is going to help us. And also, perhaps towards the end of the year, we're going to see interest rate cuts in the US. I know it's only, they're talking about only one, maybe two. I think it's going to be more than that. And I think likewise here, we're going to see more interest rates. We just got to get through the first couple of months. But I think it's going to be a much better year. And you can feel it. Trump or no Trump, you know, you just got to learn to tolerate him, just to bite on your tongue and don't let him eat your insides out. But, you know, as long as the markets go up and the world economy picks up, I think we're going to benefit from that as well.
We are optimistic about the 2025 year. We'll have to wait and see how long that optimism will hold out. But for now, we take it and we take the small wins as they continue to come through. Thanks so much, Uncle David, for that chat. Always lovely speaking to you. David Shapiro of Sasfin Wealth on market movements, some sentiment, and potentially the interest rate decision that we're in for next week.
When you're growing your money, you need to make the right choices. That's why at Standard Bank Private, we offer the best of everything. Our offshore investments are award-winning. We'll give you the best Forex rates around. As SA's biggest home loan provider, we offer unmatched expertise. And you'll have access to the best financial planners and bankers. So why not visit standardbank.co.za to join Africa's best private bank today? Standard Bank is an authorized FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
We're taking a look at the latest developments in the Gazprom Bank deal for the Mossel Bay refinery. For those of you that don't remember, Gazprom Bank was awarded the official contract for that refinery around May of 2023. And since then, we kind of haven't really seen too much movement in that respect. And now it looks as though the entire deal could be up in the air, and we don't really know where we stand on that. As always, where it comes to matters of energy and it comes to these sorts of conversations, we have our resident independent energy analyst Tsepo Radima joining us to take a look at this. Radima, dumela tat. I want to get straight into kind of where we stand here. We are in the middle of nowhere, and for some this might seem like foreign territory. But for you, in October of 2023, shortly after Gazprom was announced as the preferred bidder for this particular deal, you said, nope, this isn't going to happen, and you've been proven right.
Yes, unfortunately so. I think the deal has always been between the middle of somewhere and nowhere. There's no way Gazprom Bank would ever have been a technical partner. Gazprom Bank controls a lot of gas reserves in Russia, but all they know to do is to produce gas. They don't know anything else to do with gas. Petro SA is the first company on this planet to have commercialized conversion of natural gas into synthetic fuels and petrochemicals. Obviously, as time went by, that position was taken over by Sasol as well as Shell, and they have proceeded to go and build even much more bigger plants. But from a technical expertise, as well as from the patents to the specific way that Petro SA has, it's only Petro SA that has got that technology. So it never made sense from day one why Gazprom Bank was chosen, and any of the other bidders also, by the way, neither had the technical know-how nor the financial capacity. Now, Gazprom Bank, ordinarily, one would expect that they would have had the financial capacity, except that when I stated that the deal was a non-starter, was premised largely on the fact that Russia and Russian companies, such as Gazprom and the others, were all under U.S. sanctions. And there was just absolutely no way they were ever going to, you know, this deal was ever going to see the light of day. But the then, I mean, the now still the Minister of Minerals, Minister Gwede Mantashe, then insisted that the deal would have been closed by April 2024. And here we are now, a year later almost. Of course, that which I pronounced has come to pass, unfortunately. But it means, therefore, that going forward, with the advent of President Trump and his pronouncements, particularly on saying Alaska will now be the new El Dorado in terms of energy supply to the world, there is absolutely no way that any other potential partner to Petro SA will be able to raise the necessary capital to get Mossel Bay up and moving. I think Mossel Bay Refinery, that story effectively was done and dusted 10 years ago. And when I was appointed chairman of Petro SA 11 years ago, was, 10 years ago, actually, I mean, I was keenly aware of the risks and the dangers that were lurking. And that one of those being that refinery was on the verge of closure. And once you closed it, there was just absolutely no way, because there is no indigenous supply of feedstock to get that refinery working. And we knew that, by the way, as early as 2012, that Petro SA ran out of gas reserves. And there's no way that you could ever even, once you shut that refinery down, it becomes the end. And I think in the final analysis, they will just have to sell that equipment for scrap and hopefully still retain the technology and maybe try and apply the technology in other jurisdictions in the world.
That doesn't sound like a very optimistic story, but I want to look at what's currently happening. We'll come back to the potential possibilities here, because I think there is a story around that and what we could potentially do there. But currently, it's costing upwards of 500 million rand a year to maintain. So what is being maintained there?
Well, the plant is in care and maintenance. So they do have people that are employed there, but a large workforce of Petro SA right now is on the payroll but unemployed, because They're doing very little. I know that they are producing from the historical feedstock of condensate. They are producing some sludge, which they are selling on the market. And that is further refined to produce either, you know, light burner fuel or even HFO by some refiners, small-scale refiners. But that is not a sustainable business model. And secondly, the terminal that they have, they've largely resorted to using it for supply of diesel into Eskom. The open cycle gas turbine power station. Now, we know as a matter of fact that, you know, Eskom was never supposed to be burning as much diesel. So the business model is completely way out of the window. Now, how long can they continue to show up and pay that $500 million? That was only made possible because they had Eskom as a customer to supply diesel to. And once that customer evaporates, they will have to now try and become a trader, but a small trader all the same. So they will not be able to generate sufficient positive cash flows and profits to be able to continue to maintain that plant. And over and above that, they sit with an environmental liability. I know that it was reported that the environmental liability is around 10 billion. From my last count, having, you know, or knowing that company for what it is, the total environmental liability is around 24 billion. So effectively, we are sitting here with a technically and effectively financially insolvent entity. And I can't see how the auditors will be able to confirm that it's a going concern. But the blame lies squarely on the shoulders of the Minister of Energy. He should never have, even for once, thought that it would be possible to have a deal sealed with Gazprom Bank or even any of those bidders on the reasons I've advanced. They did not have either the technical know-how and expertise to do that which PetroSA requires to get that refinery working, nor the financial capacity. And today, the capital markets are going to look towards what is happening in the US. So you can't tap into the capital markets, unfortunately, for us.
I can understand why the blame is being placed on the Minister of the DMRE or the Minister of Mineral Resources. From your perspective, is that the appointment of the Gazprom Bank was the responsibility of Cabinet and not necessarily that of PetroSA themselves. What of the consequences? Because part of the appointment and part of all these things, there was even supposed to be a feasibility study done to the tune of some $3 million, and that ended up, instead of Gazprom Bank having to pay for that, that ended up being a bill that was footed by South Africa as well to have that feasibility study done. So what of consequences here around a deal that someone got, everything was supposedly going through, and then you don't live up to your end of the deal?
Yeah, I mean, it is puzzling as to why PetroSA required an outside party to pay for the you know, feasibility study, because PetroSA in the period in review, they were generating sufficient profits from their trading of diesel to Eskom at such huge margins that they would have afforded to have come up with that money themselves. But at the same time, they should have looked at themselves directly as a state-owned company, tapping directly into the capital markets without looking at the middleman. And also, the minister, more than anyone else, should have keenly been aware that Russian companies, and particularly Russian state-owned companies, not a single one of them are experienced foreign direct investors. So when you look at what is reported as alleged pushback when PetroSA staff and management wanted to expedite the process, and being told that actually we have got political backing, that is typical of Russian entities. That's why they don't feature anywhere on this planet in terms of being foreign direct investors, because their culture, their corporate culture, is not suited for a corporate culture of a country such as that of South Africa. But even if you were to say, look, let's look at internationally, Is it Japan? Is it China? Is it Europe? Is it North America? The opportunity to invest in Mossel Bay, that opportunity is long gone. I would say this. The long-term sustainability of Petro SA rests in leveraging of the patented gas-to-liquids technology or Fischer Tropsch that they have to then look at becoming a global gas-to-liquids champion, which was effectively what, when I was chairman of the board, that is the vision that I outlined, that Petro SA needed to be a national champion as far as liquid fuels are concerned for South Africa, whereby Petro SA should have now been accounting for at least 30% of the market share in liquid fuels to ensure that South Africa remains energy secure on the liquid fuels front. But at the same time, that they should then have, at that time, the vision I put was that we needed to leverage of that patented technology then to become a global champion in terms of gas to liquids, because many countries have got vast reserves of gas, but they don't have the know-how. And that includes the United States, by the way. So now I'm astonished that there isn't even a conversation between our president and the newly inaugurated president of the United States to say, yes, on your drill, baby, drill mantra, how then we bring about our technical know-how and expertise in conversion of gas into liquid fuels as well as petrochemicals to then be a solid partner, technology partner to the United States, taking into account that all the capital now is going to find a home in the US hydrocarbons as well as the energy markets, as opposed to other jurisdictions and more obscure jurisdictions such as South Africa.
Could this be the definition of a wasted opportunity? Only time will tell. At the moment, it doesn't look very good. But that's all the time we do have for this conversation. Thank you so much, Ragadima, for those insights. Tsepo Ragadima, independent energy analyst, joining us to take a look at the Petro SA Gazprom Bank deal that's seemingly dead in the water.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Now, there have been some interesting developments in the employment space, especially where it relates to the Employment Equity Act. There are certain amendments that have come into effect from the 1st of January this year. But there's also been a government gazette dealing with good labor practices where it relates to dismissals. We're going to take a look at both of these, and we're going to be joined on the line by a director from Cliff Dekker Hofmeyr, Professor Hugo Pinot, to help us try and get our heads around exactly what these changes are and what they mean. Prof. Pinot, good evening. Thanks so much for taking the time. Let's start by taking a look at the amendments and the effective dates, that's or the amendments specifically that have come up. What amendments are we talking about here?
So, Employment Equity Act, and the one is pertaining to the definition of a designated employer, and the second one is with regards to the Minister's powers to issue directives and to different targets in different sectors at certain levels. So if we could start with the first one, I can talk to that briefly if you want.
Yes, yes, yes.
So you remember the Act came into operation during 1998. That's the Employment Equity Act, with the main focus on addressing unfair discrimination, and the second one to deal with affirmative action. And that is a relevant bit one here. And what the Act did, it had a definition of a designated employer who was then duty-bound to comply with certain provisions under Chapter 3 of the Act. And that dealt with provisions such as submitting employment equity plans, doing an analysis, consulting, etc., and reports. So it's quite onerous, but of course necessary. So what happened in terms of the amendments that came into operation on the 1st of January this year is that they amended that designated employer provision. Now, the designated employer provision meant that every employer who has more than 50 and more than 50 employees had to comply with the provisions of this Act, in other words, submit reports, etc. But the second one is a so-called turnover clause, which has now been deleted. And the purpose of that is to make it easier for the small employer. So what the turnover clause did historically was to say that if your turnover is more than that of a small employer, and there's a diagram schedule 4 in the Act. So for instance, if you're a farmer and if you're in agriculture and your turnover is more than 6 million per annum, or if you're in manufacturing and your turnover is more than 30 million per annum, then irrespective of your number of employees, you may have 10 employees, but you must still comply with the provisions of Chapter 3. In other words, do employment equity reports, analysis, consult reports, etc., and submit plans. Now, that clause and that provision, as I've said, has now been taken out of the Act. So the idea and the purpose was to make it easier for the small employer and to accommodate them in terms of complying with onerous labor legislation. So that was a positive one experienced by business, and more in particular the smaller employers. One would hope that they don't think that they shouldn't still apply affirmative action measures. But of course, it's not strictly governed anymore because of the definition of the turnover clause that was deleted. So that's the first bit.
Now, alongside these amendments, there was a government gazette that was put out yesterday that further speaks to certain aspects of the labor provisions, or a draft regulation from that perspective, around codes of good practice. I want to get a sense of what this means and how this relates to the employment equity amendments.
Yeah. So first of all, the second one that came out yesterday, the Gazette of yesterday, does not impact on the Employment Equity Act. Just on the Employment Equity Act, the second important amendment was providing the minister with powers to set targets for at different levels in different sectors over a five-year plan. So the minister will now set targets for employers to comply with in terms of the next 5 years, and those would be designated employers. But yesterday's gazette was an interesting one, and what it really did, we've had that talk from within the corridors of Parliament and otherwise, that they need to make the provisions of the Act, in particular the Labour Relations Act, more or less onerous, and it's almost in line with the thinking sometimes where people would say, if it's easier to fire, it's easier to hire. I don't necessarily support that, but there is that thinking out there. So what they did is there's a Schedule 8 in the Act, which they've now published a new Schedule 8 to allow people 60 days to respond to that and make comments, and that will then come into force after further process being followed. But that is really to simplify disciplinary hearings, in particular for the smaller employer, and generally for the other grounds of dismissal, which is misconduct, incapacity, or operational requirements, to streamline that. So what has happened in terms of our developments in our law is that despite the wording of the Act, disciplinary inquiries have become extremely onerous and cumbersome for employers to apply, and the courts have said repeatedly a disciplinary hearing is not akin to a criminal or a civil matter. Simplify it. You need to comply with the Audi Ultram. And what this code is doing, this new code, in draft format, is to provide guidance for a simplified procedure, whether you dismiss. And it says it's the code is intentionally general, and it applies a small first, but just to small employers. Said if you want to have a hearing, send a letter to the employee, explain what he did and generally the charges, allow the employee to respond in writing to the charges and the proposed sanction, and let the employee have a representative to assist. Submit that in writing, a chairperson will consider that, and that will still constitute a fair procedure, which is quite different from what we have in many companies at the moment. But then, of course, there's gazette of yesterday, which has been substituted today to fix certain grammar and other mistakes. But it still deals with the misconduct type of dismissals, still deals with operational requirements dismissals. It still deals, incidentally, with dismissals during strike action, particular unprotected strikes, and of course it deals with the issues of misconduct for operational requirements. So that's a new code, and people will read and comment, and my sense is it will be welcomed by business, And the huge debate would be what constitutes a small employer. Is it somebody with 10 employees, or is it somebody where they simply say a smaller employers may adopt a less formal approach? And what's the meaning then of smaller employers?
Now, while this draft is out for comment, it is out for comment for the next 60 days, I believe. I want to get your thoughts on something, Prof, around the concerns that exist there. What are some of the other concerns? You highlighted one important one around the definition of a small business and how that's going to be measured. What are some of the other concerns you picked up around the draft that may need to be addressed before we can have a finalized version?
Well, first of all, I like the more informal approach. I have no doubt that the unions will say this may lead to a further exploitation of labor, as to use their terms. But generally speaking, I think what you need to do is to send the message for employers to start and consider amending their current codes and practices. If your disciplinary code is currently as part of an agreement with the union, it's not that easy to amend. But otherwise, the message is certainly out there for employers to have a more informal relationship, and they can in processes amend their code and procedure, which will make it easier for them. Generally, the criticism would be that it's too vague, but as the legislator said, it's a guide. In other words, it is not cast in stone, and it creates scope for a fair process. And generally, if as the code says, there must be a genuine dialogue when you get to fair procedures. And sometimes I think it's good to have a bit more of a guide as opposed to strict guidelines, and in particular a guide that is probably more intentionally general than specific. So I have no quarrel with that.
Certainly a lot of changes happening in the employment space, both from an employment equity perspective, but also from a labor relations perspective. We'll have to wait and see how these continue to unfold. Of course, some of these changes already effective from the 1st of January. We'll leave the conversation there, Prof. Thanks so much for the time and for the insights. Professor Hugo Pienaar, Director at Cliff Dekker Hofmeyr, on some of the changes in terms of employment legislation.
My name is Frank Leonette, CEO and founder of South Africa's newest crypto exchange called Afridex. I will be on the MoneyWeb crypto podcast with Kieran Ryan to explain why we believe South Africa could benefit from a new crypto exchange and how we differ from the existing exchanges. Join us this week to find out more.
Don't forget, join me, Kieran Ryan, weekly on the MoneyWeb crypto podcast. Listen on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify.
MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
Now, the FSA has been looking into the contributions of employers where it relates to pension funds on behalf of their employees. And there has been a growing trend of employers defaulting and not making these contributions, in growing so much so that we now sit north of 5 billion rand in contributions that have not been made by employers. The FSCA has had enough. They are going to be taking action around this, and they're exploring what they can do to get those that haven't been paying to start paying. I'm joined on the line by Zarina Kamruddin, who is the head for fund governance and trustee conduct at the Financial Sector Conduct Authority, to take a look at this and see what's planned here. Good evening, Zarina. Thanks so much for taking the time. How did we get to 5 billion rand of unpaid contributions? How long has this been going on for?
So good evening to you and to the listeners, and thank you for affording the FSCA this platform. So the issue of mid-year contributions, it's not something that's happened overnight. As you can imagine, with, as you indicated, being north of 5 billion rand in mid-year contributions, this has been a long-standing problem. But I think what has happened with the two-part system implementation is that it's basically amplified and brought attention to this problem, because when members try to access, their savings component during the two-part implementation period, they weren't able to do so because they were either some of them had no funds or insufficient funds to access anything from their savings withdrawal component. So I think that has shone the spotlight, squarely on arrear contributions. Mm. Yeah, so it's long story short, it's a long-standing problem, but it's a problem that we are trying by all means to arrest as the FSCA together with other social partners.
Zarina, do we know which businesses specifically have not been contributing? I mean, we know that the likes of the private security sector have been some of the culprits there. Other examples include municipalities. Do we have kind of a more detailed list of who's not contributing and how we kind of how much each person is not contributing at this stage, or each organization, employer?
Well, I think we have a good breakdown because we, you know, we do obtain information from the funds as to who is not paying. So, as you rightly point out, the private security sector, that's one of the main culprits of non-compliant, you know, employers. Then you have the hairdressing, beauty, and skincare industry. That's another. And bargaining council, I'd say employers who participate in bargaining council funds in general, that's you know, a big problem as well. So whether it's building, metal, transport, contract cleaning, electrical, you know, furniture, etc., we see this trend in bargaining council / sectoral funds. So that's one of the big problems. And as you rightly indicated, you also have the municipalities, the municipal funds, where the municipalities have not been paying over the contributions that they ought to have been paying over. So we have quite a good idea of who the main culprits are, you know, in respect of the non-payment of contributions.
Zarina, what is the FSCA looking to do here? What options are you looking to explore? Because I think what some people might be missing here is that according to the Pension Funds Act, it is actually a criminal offence not to pay these contributions. So this is not a misdemeanor. This is a very serious thing that I'd imagine you and other stakeholders involved here, such as the Pension Funds Adjudicator, would be looking at quite seriously. What kind of options are you exploring here from an accountability perspective?
Well, you know, that's a very good question. So we're looking at various aspects. So one of it is we're engaging the National Prosecuting Authority. We have engaged them, you know, during the course of last year, and we are going to continue with those discussions with the NPA because, of course, I think a strong signal will be sent out if we see people in orange overalls, which even though that's obviously not ideal for anyone, but, you know, if you are not going to bring your part, and as you rightly point out, it's a statutory crime. It's also a common law crime of theft. If you deduct contributions as an employer and you don't pay it over, a strong message needs to go out. So there has been some cases that have been quite successful already. If you look at Kai Harib, you know, in respect of that municipality, there's been arrest effective there, as well as I think it's in the Oosterberg municipality and Kamisberg municipalities as well in the Northern Cape. So we'd like to see more of that happening so that, you know, the non-compliant employers are dealt with as they ought to be dealt with, very severely. And fortunately, we also have recent cases that were just handed down, in fact, a couple of days ago. So you have the Municipal Workers' Retirement Fund case that was handed down on the 17th of January by the Bloemfontein High Court. It's MWRF versus Mafube Local Municipality, where the court there held, you know, the municipal managers, executive mayor, etc., personally liable. And they also referred the matter to the NPA, or the Director of Public Prosecutions in Bloemfontein, to investigate the matters and obviously to take criminal action as well. So those are one of you know, the avenues that we are exploring quite vociferously. The other thing is, of course, is to engage boards, you know, to say, you know, what about considering making these paid up for the period or suspending contributions for the period, obviously with the relevant stakeholders being engaged until you get into a state of compliance, but still continue paying your risk benefits and your admin costs, for example. So those are some of the things that we're looking at. Enforceable undertakings, which worked quite well, as you may know, with the ANC Staff Provident Fund, you know, where there was an enforceable undertaking between the fund as well as the employer and the FSCA. And that has worked quite successfully because you know, the ANC has been making their contributions to in terms of the enforceable undertaking. So there are various avenues that we're exploring to address this problem of their contributions.
Zarina, what of the role of the pension fund administrators? I know those are regulated by the FSCA. Is there some room there to say that some of the responsibility or some obligation kind of sits there? Because from that perspective, you could quite easily deal with non-compliant administrators, if any. But obviously, we understand that some of the administrators can only really do their jobs when the end contributor actually makes their contributions. But is there something that we can do from a pension fund administrator point of view?
Well, the primary duty and the fiduciary duty actually lies with the trustees of the fund. So in other words, with the board of the fund. So with administrators, that is actually the duty of or administration. It's in fact the duty of the board as well, but they outsource that duty. So the primary responsibility really resides with the boards of funds. But if they, for example, outsource as a function to say, you know, write to the non-compliant employers to find out who the managing director is or the director is responsible for the management of the financial affairs, you know, of the employer, etc. I mean, those are the types of things that they can do. But ultimately, the responsibility resides with boards of the fund. And they, you know, even though it's a delegated function, they can't abdicate that responsibility. So, as I said, duties may be, I suppose, delegated as well to the administrator to say, right to the non-compliant employers, but ultimately the board owes that fiduciary duty to the member to take the necessary steps to ensure that arrear contributions and contributions are paid.
Contributions need to be paid. People's pensions and livelihoods depend on it, and the FSCA will make sure that they do what they can to bring those that are not contributing to book. We'll leave the conversation there, Zarina. Thanks so much for the time and for the insights. That's Zarina Kamruddin, who is the head for finance, for fund governance and trustee conduct at the Financial Sector Conduct Authority, on the unpaid pension contributions by employers.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Around this time on a Wednesday, we typically have conversations with leading senior executives in the country and around the world, trying to get to know them a little bit better. This week is no different. We are joined on the line by the new CEO of Rosont, interesting company that does quite a few things in the drilling and exploration space in South Africa. I'm joined on the line by Glenn McGavigan to take a look at what he does, what he's going to get up to within the business. Good evening, Glenn. Thanks so much for taking the time. Effective last week, you assumed the position of CEO. First of all, congratulations on that. We wish you the best of success and luck in the business. Let's get into how you got to this point.
Yeah, good evening, Jimmy, and thanks for the opportunity to be part of your show. It's really, really exciting to be, you know, given the opportunity to be CEO of Rosont. It's a company I've known for many years, you know, throughout my career, having worked with them. So, you know, to be given the privilege to be part of the team is really awesome for me. So just in terms of a bit of background to me, so, you know, professionally I study geology. So that's, like you mentioned, Rosont being an exploration company, that's how I got to know them over many years, about 20 years. So professionally I'm a geologist by training. Did a bit of extra studies in rock engineering and mining engineering. And I've been working for the last 26 years in the field of mining. And, you know, various opportunities, various disciplines. Worked on the mines, particularly in the Northern Cape. I spent about 11 years in the Northern Cape in various roles in geology and geotechnical engineering, working on one of the biggest iron ore mines in the world, you know, Sishen Iron Ore Mine. Spent a lot of time there. Then I also got opportunities to move into the corporate office at Anglo American at Kumba Iron Ore, where I was the head of geology for about 5 years. And then I got given also the opportunity about 8 years ago to be the executive head for Kumba Iron Ore for the technical department and the projects department, which was a fantastic opportunity and an awesome job in an awesome company. Now I've had the opportunity to join Rosont. I left Anglo American and Kumba in about April this year. decided to take some time off, almost like a mid-career reset. Had to do a bit of thinking around what I wanted to do, and then started looking for opportunities, and the Rosemont one came up, and I'm really excited and looking forward to what lies ahead there.
Glenn, you really like rocks, don't you?
I do.
So what do you do at Rosemont? What does Rosemont do as a business, and how do they kind of fit into the mining space, and why did you choose them after so many years in the industry?
No, so Rosemont's the company 67 years old, so a well-established company in South Africa. They're the biggest exploration drilling company. So essentially what Rosemont does, it does the drilling and looks for ore bodies for mining companies, and helps to find those ore bodies through collecting information through geological drilling. So a quite big company, all in all about 1,200 employees at various sites around South Africa, from the Northern Cape to Limpopo to Northwest, Gauteng, Free State, about 35 sites where Rosemont operates. And so a large company, and the leading exploration drilling company in South Africa. Why did I decide to join them? It was interesting when I left and took some time off. I thought to myself, what do I want to do? And you don't really in your career get that chance to actually pause and think about it. And what I actually realized was, although I studied rocks, what I really like and what I really enjoy about mining in South Africa is people. So I was really looking to come to a company where, had awesome people, which Rosemont does. But I think also more importantly, where you feel like you fit. I want to say fit in terms of values. I think it's awesome if you can find a place where you walk in and you feel like you're part of the family, and that's exactly what Rosemont has given me. So that's why I chose Rosemont. A nice fit for me, and having been in the company for a couple of weeks, and having known the company for a while, there's huge opportunities, not only in South Africa but internationally, for us to expand our footprint and do what we do very well in South Africa elsewhere in on the globe as well.
Glenn, what are you looking most forward to about this new challenge that you're about to embark on?
For me, it's to take a really well-established business and stop and pause and think about what it could be. And I think it's not very often you get an opportunity to do that and be asked to do that. So I think really taking the core business, which is drilling, looking how we expand that, both in South and Southern Africa, but also into really exciting geographies like Saudi Arabia, where we've got a joint venture partner in that region. But then also thinking about, being a drilling company, we're often on the ground first at any mining site around the world. How can we add more value, to our clients, because we are there? So really, like I said, not a lot of times you get the opportunity to have a bit of a blank slate and to think about, what this company could become. That really is what I'm looking forward to.
Glenn, what do you do outside of work when you're not looking at rocks and you're not doing rock engineering things? What do you do?
So work takes up a lot of time, and the thing about our type of work is, just because you leave the office doesn't mean you're not thinking about work. So I've got to be very conscious to limit myself to make sure I've got a good balance. So outside of work, I love spending time with my family. Obviously, it's I've got a wife and two awesome children, so I like spending time with them. And then I enjoy staying active, try to keep fit, and every once in a while, if I can get two or three games of golf in every year, that's a win for me. So spending time with family and keeping active is really what I try and do and what I enjoy.
Glenn, when you're away from the family, what is it that you missed most about the time that you get to spend with them?
It's interesting. So when I was reflecting on taking the time off, this word time keeps on coming up for me, and time is finite, so we've only got a certain amount of time. So how you spend it, at work, on yourself, working on yourself, working on your health, being with your family is really, really important. So what I actually just miss is the time I spent with them, and it's not doing anything specific, but just, having dinner together, being with the kids when they get up for school in the mornings. So just being close to the family is really what I miss. And I think as well, in work can take up a lot of that time. So you got to be really conscious to be quite disciplined around it. But like I said, time is a finite resource. So
Time is a finite resource and family is everything. We're going to have to leave the conversation there, Glenn. Thanks so much for the time. It's been lovely to get to know you a little bit better. That was Glenn McGavigan, who is the CEO of Rosant, joining us as part of our executive lounge. As I said, time was not on our side because it's coming up to 7 o'clock, which means Greg Host is standing by to give you the latest round of evening news, followed by Michael Abramson and the top sport team. From my side, good night.